From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. All the world's a global stage, and we know it's a lot more complicated than just having McDonald's golden arches firmly planted in Paris and confusion about what to do with the euro. Adventurer and investor Jim Rogers decided the only way to really understand what's going on in this global galaxy was to see for himself how people really lived in their huts and hamlets around the world. He loaded up his yellow Mercedes and sped off the beaten path to Angola, Colombia, East Timor. 116 countries in all, 152,000 miles, a three-year journey through war zones, deserts, epidemics, jungles and blizzards. Jim Rogers has returned with fresh perspective and frank talk on where he sees this big, wide world heading, economically, politically, socially. Tonight on Point, Jim Rogers and the ultimate investor's road trip. How do you see the forces of globalization in play on the world stage today? Are you investing your money in foreign markets? What have your travels around the world taught you about how the peoples of the world relate to one another socially, financially, politically? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now from New York is the investor and author Jim Rogers. His new book is Adventure Capitalist, The Ultimate Investor's Road Trip. His first book was the bestseller Investment Biker. Jim, welcome to the show.
Julian, I am delighted to be here, and I just want to tell you that you're part of the reason that I'm still alive, because we listen to the BBC and to NewsHour every day, all day long, to know what was going on in the world, and we probably wouldn't have made it without you.
Jim, you're very kind. Now, you made this.
No, I'm not. You saved my life. I mean, how kind can a person be?
Jim, you made this journey only years ago. You made this journey only years after making a similar trip by motorbike. Why? Were there countries, places that you'd missed out?
Well, I guess I have a defective gene, Julian, because this is my idea of fun, to go out there and see the world close to the ground and figure out what's really going on. I look back at the map from the first trip and from the second trip. I'm a little surprised to be alive, but boy, we're very happy to be alive. We're ecstatic to be alive. I just can't get enough of it.
You wanted to get close to the ordinary people, but was it really the best way to do it in a sunburst yellow, custom-built 4x4 Mercedes convertible?
Well, we had to have 4x4, or we wouldn't have made it, obviously. You can't go around the world unless you've got high clearance above the ground. We had to have a four-wheel drive. We had to have a diesel engine. So we had to have a few things which you cannot get in most cars, most normal cars. And to our amazement, and part of my plan was that if we had a bright yellow car, it might attract attention and therefore introduce us to people. It was successful beyond my wildest dreams. I cannot tell you how many tens of millions of times that car was photographed and how many people we met as a result.
Now, it's difficult to know where to start on this epic journey of yours. Let's just pick Africa out of a hat. You went to Angola, still then in the grip of a civil war, not the usual venue for a tourist. Why did you want to go?
Well, we wanted to see as much of Africa as possible. Our original plan was to go down the West Coast and then back up the East Coast, something which I don't think has ever been done by anybody. We didn't think we would make it, largely because of that war in Angola. But lo and behold, we went one country at a time, and the next thing you knew, we'd made it. And most amazing.
And you were
listening to NewsHour and BBC Africa all the way.
And that took you to the front line of the fighting.
Oh, yes. We went right through the front lines. We shouldn't have been there. Looking back on it, it was really nuts. And we were very lucky. The only night on this whole trip that my now wife, Paige, cried out of fear was when the Angolan general made us stop in camp with his soldiers one night. She cried plenty of times, Julian, and she was scared plenty of times. But this was the only time she cried out of fear.
And what kind of people did you meet in Africa? Did you meet peasants?
Oh, yes. I mean, Africa is largely made up of peasants. And so we stayed in barnyards. We stayed in places that weren't really hotels. We ate beside the road, just like everybody in Africa eats beside the road. We went to the market. By the time Paige got this far into the trip, she was an intrepid traveler. She would do anything. She'd wander off by herself. She loved going to the markets, meeting the women, talking to the women. We did a lot of that.
And what did you learn from them? What did you learn from those market women who, particularly in West Africa, are such a source of wisdom?
Well, the main thing we learned is that we're all exactly the same, Julian. Those women want the same thing for their kids that you that everybody listening to this show wants for their kids. They want to be happy. They want to be successful. They care about how their children look. It didn't matter who we were photographing. They would always grab their little kid and comb his or her hair. This could have been Greenwich, Connecticut. This could have been just about anywhere in the world. And the other thing, which is important, that we found anyway, is that people everywhere in the world are afraid of people and things they don't know about. No matter where we were, they would say, where are you going next? And we would say, we're going to X. And they would always say, oh, gosh, that's dangerous. Those people, you'll get killed over there. And when we got there, of course, they said the same thing about the next place we were going. So it's a shame that everybody's so afraid of each other. If we would just get out there and see each other, there wouldn't be much problem in the world at all.
Now, Angola was just one of a number of African countries you visited. You also went to Namibia, South Africa, Egypt. But one of your conclusions was Africa could feed itself and export food again, but not when its farmers are up against subsidized Western agriculture and free lunches. Did that make you angry?
Oh, it made me furious because it's my tax dollars. It's all of our tax dollars. And it is amazing. You would come to African countries and you would see Africans who now think that the way to eat is to go down to the monthly or weekly or whatever it happens to be food distribution of aid from the U.S., from Europe, from wherever. This is a whole generation of Africans are growing up not able to farm because they've never had to learn. And another generation has been put out of business because they cannot compete with free food. We would go over to the market and the farmers were just, you know, they couldn't produce food to compete with the free food sent in from the West. Same thing is happening with tailors. There are tailors that were, on my last trip, tailors everywhere in Africa. Now America and Europe and Japan send in all these free clothes, and so the tailors and the farmers are being put out of business.
And in Senegal, you came across a massive scam involving donations of clothes from the United States.
Oh, yes. You know, every church in America gathers clothes together, secondhand clothes, and sends them to Africa for the distribution to the poor, starving Africans, as they're told. But what happens, somewhere between the church and the U.S., they wind up with intermediaries who take them to Africa and then sell them. They wholesale them in Africa, and then the Africans take them out to the various markets, and the women are sitting there selling these clothes. You can see clothes with the Jacksonville Red Cross written on it, or the University of Oklahoma written on it. All of this stuff comes from churches, but it winds up being sold in Africa and putting tailors and farmers out of business.
In fact, in very general terms, you didn't come away from your trip, not just to Africa, but to other parts of the world, with a very favorable view of foreign aid. You describe NGOs as big business spawned by government corruption. These cash cows have succeeded only in inserting numerous middlemen between the foreign aid and corrupt governments.
And they are just as corrupt themselves. The Africans call them, and not just the Africans, the Asians, the South Americans, call them the new colonialists. They ride around in air-conditioned 4x4s with their windows up. They all live in special compounds. They live much better than they could live in their home country, in the U.S. You know, Lord Jim was written about people like this. Conrad had seen people like this. And they're not very attractive in my mind, nor are they very attractive to the Africans.
And did you have to go to Africa to discover such things?
Well, it's a lot more, it hits you in the face a lot easier. I guess I could have sat here in New York and theorized that it was probably happening, but until you've been there and you see it right away, and every day you see it, you know it's for real. One African journalist told me that, you know, if these colonialists, or these NGOists, as she called them, really thought they were doing such good things for us Africans, why don't they send their kids to the schools they're building for us? Her point was, of course, that all these NGO people send their kids back to England or someplace else for school. They're too good to go to the schools they're building for the Africans.
Let's skip to another continent. In Asia, you were struck by the shortage of girls. That's a statement that sort of hangs in the air a bit.
Yes, it is extraordinary that there is a huge shortage of girls developing in Asia. In Korea, for instance, right now, for every 100 14-year-old Korean girls, there are 120 14-year-old Korean boys. In parts of India, they cannot find wives at the moment. Last year in China, there were 117 boys born for every 100 girls. The status of women is going to change very dramatically in Asia in the next few years.
And do you see business opportunities as a result of this observation?
Well, of course, whenever there's a shortage of something, there are going to be unintended consequences. Interestingly enough, Julian, 1,000 years ago in Europe, there was a shortage of women for a variety of reasons, and men's families paid dowries 1,000 years ago. In Asia now, in many countries, the women's family pay the dowries. So you can see the kind of change which is coming as women become more and more valuable. Those 14-year-old girls are going to become 24-year-old women, and they can have any guy they want, and they will know it. It will change politics, economics. It will change society. It will change education. And whenever you have massive changes like that, there are obviously opportunities.
You traveled extensively in South Korea, but you never got to the North. Did you try?
We asked the North Koreans if they would let us in, and you know, they said no, of course. There's not really any way we could have gotten in because the border between North and South Korea at that time was pretty close. It's still a military minefield.
Now, you didn't get there, but you were able to reach one conclusion, well, a conclusion at the time a couple of years ago. North Korea, you said, is no conceivable threat to us.
Well, I don't see how they are. It's a country of 22 million people, which is really tiny. South Korea alone has nearly 45 million people. North Korean's neighbors are China, with 1.5 billion people, Japan, with 125 million people, South Korea, and Russia. All of those countries have huge armies, huge war chests, huge treasuries. They could spend as much money as they needed to. There's no way that North Korea can bomb the U.S., even if they did have one missile or two missiles. They're no threat to the U.S., and if there are a threat to anybody, they are a threat to their neighbors, and it should be a problem for their neighbors to solve, not for you, me, and our tax dollars.
Now, Jim, we got an admirer of yours calling from Madison, Wisconsin, Habu. Habu, what did you want to say?
Yes, good evening to both of you, and hello, Mr. Rogers. I used to watch you on CNBC. And you always had a mind of your own, and unlike all these other people who are so eager to fall in line. So I admired you from that standpoint also. But anyway, this is a question I want to ask you, since you've been around the world. Side with people like Vandana Shiva from India, who you know who are fighting for the ordinary people to keep their water and the seeds, which are the commons, and fighting against Monsanto just coming in there and wholesale and taking up tracts wholesale and making people indentured to their crops. What do you think about this line of development that the activists are fighting?
Well, I'm certainly not in favor of anybody being indentured to anyone or anybody else. As you well know from having seen me on TV, I certainly think everyone should be independent in thought as well as in physical action. So I certainly don't want to be in favor of indentured. But what is necessary, and you hit it, India could really do a whole lot better if the people could, in fact, produce their own food and have larger tracts than they do right now. One of the problems in India is that the government under Nehru before decreed that there could be no large farms. Nobody can have more than 10 or 12 acres. Well, a lot of those Indians, a lot of the people there are very successful and smart and hardworking people. And if they could have larger farms themselves, then India would be much more competitive and much more productive. So I'm all in favor of somehow or another changing the laws in India so that peasants, as you call them, small farmers, can in fact become larger and more successful.
Habu, you satisfied with that answer?
Yes, but you know, there is also something to be said about even people having a small tract of land to be able to live on that. In those countries, unlike here it's a different story. But in these other countries, land, it means everything to these people.
That's why I say I would hope that India would change its laws so that people can own more land and can own land instead of having taken away.
Jim, we're going to have to take a break. We're talking tonight about the financial, social and geopolitical landscape of the world today with the venture capitalist Jim Rogers, who's returned from a record-setting three-year road trip around the world. What have your own travels around the world taught you about nationalism, the global community? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about world markets, economies, social customs with Jim Rogers. He spent 3 years driving his yellow Mercedes around the world, 116 countries through blinding snow and searing heat, to feel for himself where the world is heading in the 21st century. What do you make of Jim Rogers' globe-trotting wisdom? Is it too optimistic, pessimistic, dead-on? Can you imagine, as Jim Rogers advocates, living in a world without passports? Can nationalism coexist with global citizenship? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim, what struck you going around the world was that even in this age of globalization, people are struggling, in fact, probably because of globalization, to hang on to their national identities.
Yes, many large empires have been built in the last 300 years. You know, the English learned how to sail better than anybody else, and so they built huge empires. But most of those empires and nation states got bigger and bigger and bigger, and most of them did not and do not work. Russia is already broken. The Soviet Union is broken up into 15 states. Czechoslovakia is broken up. Ethiopia and Eritrea have split. Yugoslavia is maybe six countries now, because most of us will all dance to Michael Jackson and drive Toyotas, perhaps, and drink Coca-Cola. But most of these big empires and big nation states did not work and do not work. So people are looking for something they can understand and control: their own ethnic group, their own tribe, to use that term, their own linguistic group. So you're going to see more and more of this as time goes on.
Let's go to a part of the world which has seen the decline of an empire in recent years. So what was the Soviet Union? What is now Russia? Now, you had a bit to do there with Russian mobsters.
Yes, we did, Julian. One night we were sitting in a restaurant and we could see the mob over there. And the guy came over to us. They all wear very short hair. They shave their heads, and they all wear black suits. The guy came over and said, "How did you get so far into Siberia without paying anybody off?" I, of course, tried to bluff and said, "How do you know we didn't pay somebody off?" And he said, "I know you haven't, because I've checked," at which point I got very scared. The most efficient people in Russia are the mob. They control everything. And when we left, after drinking a lot of vodka with him over the next 2 or 3 days, he said, "Listen, if anybody bothers you in the next 2 or 3 cities, you let us know and we'll have them killed." But he was serious. You and I would joke like that, but he was dead serious.
So what does that tell you then about Russia? What does it tell you about big business? What does it tell you about corporate America, maybe?
Well, to go to Russia specifically, there is capitalism in Russia, but it's outlaw capitalism. It's not the kind of capitalism I could work in, or most of your listeners could work in. But the mob does control it. Russia essentially is a disaster which is spiraling downward into a catastrophe. There are warlords cropping up in all sections of Russia, only they're called the mafia now. In history books, they would be called warlords. Each section is trying to split away and from Moscow. They're not paying much attention to Moscow. There is really not much of a future for Russia.
Okay, Ivy is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Sorry, I beg your pardon. It's Irv calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Irv, what did you want to say to Jim?
Jim, great courage. I love your books. I just want to point out that you didn't fully answer the Madison caller's question on how peasants are supposed to make it in the world today. It's this monstrous money system that's squeezing the life out of people all over the planet, including here in the home country. This Bush crime family with its Enron buddies is just the ultimate in corporate fascism. And I only hope that you can go to your peer group, the wealthies, and tell them, plead with them to expiate their sins. And basically, people need land reform around the world. They need this heavy yoke of the money system lifted. So go to these billionaires and tell them, unless they want a German Nazi Götterdämmerung here in the planet, the environment collapsing, all of it, that they better get rid of their money. Thank you.
Okay, Jim, look, a very kind of specific and impassioned question there from Irv, but in very general terms, I mean, has your trip around the world altered fundamentally the way you see it and the role of global capitalism?
Well, globalization, to use that term, and it's a dangerous term, but the opening up of markets and borders has been good for the world. If you look at the amount of world trade there's been since the Second World War, it's grown by 100 times or something. What people, many people forget is that the Second World War was partially caused by the fact that all countries closed off, tried to protect their own citizens, their own industries, and economics failed around the world. The reason we set up the World Trade Organization after the Second World War was because everybody found out we're not going to ever let that happen again. We're going to open countries up. We're going to open borders. We're going to trade with each other. We're going to make everybody more productive and wealthier. And it worked. It worked big time. Unfortunately, the people who are against this opening up of and the building up of trade around the world haven't read their history or don't remember. Most of the people who set up the World Trade Organization are long since dead. Many of the things that people who protest would do, such as closing out large companies, not that I'm necessarily a fan of large companies, but would have horrible results. If the Africans cannot trade with anybody else. The South Americans cannot trade with anybody else. They need jobs. They want to trade. Go to South America and you will see that they're desperate for jobs. The only way they're going to get jobs is to have people invest in their countries and then let those people sell to us and to Europe and to Japan.
And you're all for the breaking down of all kinds of barriers. You'd like to live in a world without passports.
Absolutely. I would have complete free trade everywhere. Then the Africans could sell to America. They could make fortunes for themselves. Their kids could have better schools, better education, better lives. Same with the South Americans. Julian, for hundreds of years, the world got along without passports. There was free movement of people throughout the history. The world didn't end.
But you wouldn't have managed this trip that you've just been on without a passport.
No. I wouldn't have gotten out of New York without a passport.
But you found crossing the border into Yugoslavia, that border guards would not accept Yugoslav money. Tell me more about that.
Right. It was before the war began in Yugoslavia. And one thing you can always, one way to learn a lot about a country very quickly is the currency. And if there's a black market, if there's a big black market, you know there's something wrong with the economy, the political system, and the country. The worst we ever came to was Yugoslavia, because when we went into Yugoslavia, the border guards would not even take their own money, the Yugoslav national currency. And as we drove down the highways, nobody would take the money. So we knew that there were serious, serious problems coming in Yugoslavia.
Jim, I got Paul calling from Newport, Rhode Island, with a question. Paul.
Thanks for taking my call. As we globalize, we tend toward a more homogenized world where everything, you know, you can go to Kansas and see a strip mall, the Home Depot, and you'll be able to go to Germany and see the same thing, and everything looks the same. And my question is, what is our model for the world? You know, who is the United States to say our idea of the strip mall, urban sprawl society is what we should impose on the rest of the world? And really, the economy of globalization is irresistible and is a tyranny, that something that people cannot resist. And this is why we need protection on the small scale to resist this kind of economic tyranny. And, you know, I just returned from Germany, and you know, the first thing that strikes you from the air is all the villages are all separate from each other, separated by open space. People, you know, eat food from the local area. They have, you know, they're still at this point. I mean, globalization is coming, but I don't know if the United States has the best model to offer. What do you think about this?
Well, Paul, I hope you will read my book, because in my book I very clearly and specifically say one of the problems with the world right now is that we, the United States, are meddling in too many other countries and are trying to throw our weight around in too many other countries, and we should let people develop as they wish. We should open our borders to trade with them so that they can sell us things and we can buy things from them. But after that, it's none of our business. If you heard me speak about North Korea a few minutes ago, you heard me say, look, that's not our business. The amount of money we've spent on the, quote, Korean situation, we could have cured cancer in this country. We've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on other people's business. So, look, I happen to agree with you that we shouldn't be throwing our weight around. You also heard me say that maybe everybody's going to drive Toyotas and dance to Madonna and drink Coca-Cola, but People want to control their own fates, and that's why you have many countries and many empires breaking up these days.
But the question is, do people really have the choice? You know, you say, well, we build a Home Depot next to you, and in 2 weeks you're shopping there, and you say, well, you see, you support it because you're shopping. Well, you don't have a choice.
Wait a minute, Paul. Who's forcing you to go to Home Depot?
It's cheaper. So in a sense, people are not going to have one man. You know, there's not going to be a one man boycott. I mean, it's just an irresistible thing that just takes control, and you can't do anything about it.
Well, I cannot control history any more than you can. If the world wants Home Depot, at one point they said that about the telegraph. At one point they said that about the automobile. The automobile is going to put all the blacksmiths out of business. Do you want to go back to riding horses and buggies?
Anyway, let's just leave it there, Jim. And if I could just put you back in your yellow Mercedes and take you to China, where you say you found the best capitalists.
Yes, they call themselves communists, as you well know, Julian, but they are right now among the best capitalists in the world. Everybody that I ran into in Asia who does business anywhere said, look, it's better and easier to do business in China than anywhere else. Forget the fact that they call themselves communists. They work very hard. They work from dawn to dusk. They save and invest 35% of their income. The country is booming. If you want investment advice from me, the best investment advice I can give you is to teach your children and grandchildren Chinese.
Gosh, that's quite a thing. But did you find the Chinese welcoming?
Oh, yes, everywhere we went. The Chinese were overwhelmed by us. We were overwhelmed by them. There was complete freedom of expression. We went to many churches and mosques and temples. To our surprise, they were all packed. The churches and temples and mosques in China are much fuller than they are in the UK or in the US. You know, I don't know where this idea that they don't have freedom of religion comes from. We saw it on the ground, and they're all in the churches.
And do you think that the Bush administration has got China right?
No, the Bush administration does not understand what's happening in China, and if the ones who do understand it are against it, they think we can control China. It's a little bit like it after the Second World War. There were people in England who thought that they could stop the U.S. from becoming the most powerful country in the world in the 20th century. They couldn't do it. You can't stop history, no matter how much people try. We cannot stop the rise of China in the 21st century.
What comes out of
it? It doesn't have to be bad for us, by the way. It could be great. We could all be friends.
What comes out very strongly from your book is this idea of a bottom-up understanding of the world. Do you think it's something that more politicians could benefit from?
Oh, gosh, yes. If I had my way, all congressmen would have to spend a couple of years outside the country just learning about the rest of the world. There's a sad statistic that something like a third of the people elected to the U.S. Congress don't even have passports when they're elected. So they have very, very little understanding of the rest of the world. And it's too bad because this does lead to this idea that we in America know what's best for the world and the world should listen to us, which, of course, I find nuts. We're making enemies. We're not making friends with that attitude.
Now, one of the more remote places you went to was Outer Mongolia, and yet you were surprised at how up to speed the country was.
Yes, it's astonishing. Because it has been so isolated for so many centuries and decades after the communists took over in the 1920s, they really have had no technological advancement at all. So when they got independence, when the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, they went straight to digital technology. You can now use digital phones and mobile phones all over Mongolia because they never had to go through the expense or bother of putting in landlines and using all those antiquated analog telephones, which the rest of us have. It's an astonishing well-wired country and not wired is the wrong term, but, you know, it's a modern, technological, up-to-date city and country as far as communications are concerned.
Did you get to eat horse in Mongolia?
We ate. Part of the point of this trip was to do what the people are doing. We ate what the people are eating everywhere we went. We had crocodile, we had porcupine, we had iguana, we had armadillo, we did have horse in Mongolia. The only thing, I ate everything. Paige, my wife, refused to eat silkworms. She refused to eat tequila worms. She refused to eat dog. But otherwise, we just ate all sorts of wonderful and interesting things.
Chris is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Chris.
Hello. A very fascinating story you have to tell and a perspective that
is gained from experiences that I would think on the whole I would have to say I'd envy. I'd love to be able to travel all around the world like you've been able to. What I wanted to ask you about is what do you think can be a role for communications technology, particularly internet technologies, in terms of sharing expertise from first world countries like the United States, like Europe, to less developed countries. A friend of mine and I are working on an idea to set up telemedicine links whereby first world highly trained medical professionals can provide advice and counsel to caregivers in, you know, West Africa and other less developed and impoverished areas where they need the medical expertise, you know, to deal with some of the complicated illnesses they may be encountering. And I'm wondering if that kind of model could be constructive, not just in the medical field, but elsewise, in helping, you know, helping develop and improve the conditions of life for people in less developed countries.
Kim?
Chris, the internet revolution is astonishingly real. We kept up a website from 116 countries. There are phone lines just about everywhere now. On my last trip, the only way we could communicate with people frequently was to send a postcard home and hope that they would find out that we were still alive. Now there is the internet in every country in the world, and there are phone lines in every country in the world. So the internet is here. It's real. It's changing people's lives. Your idea sounds like a terrific one. Your children will probably never know, never go to a post office. Your children may never know an accountant. Your children may never know a lawyer, we hope, because all of this is going to be done over the internet. But the accountant that your children know over the internet may be in India, maybe somewhere else, just like the doctor that they have in Angola may be coming from New York.
And you, Jim, were investing as you went along?
Oh, yes. Because of my background, Julian, if I see good things happening, I naturally stop and make investments. I don't just say that's interesting. But one thing that I found on this trip, on my first trip around the world, I opened many investment accounts and made a lot of investments. On this trip, when I came back, I did an assessment, and I realized I had closed as many accounts as I had opened. Unfortunately, some countries are closing off rather than opening up, and that will not be good for their citizens or for the world.
And a single tip that you have for listeners?
The most important place to invest in the next few years, well, China. You should definitely invest in China, but you should definitely invest in commodities. The stock market's not going to be great.
Jim, we'll take a break. We're talking with Jim Rogers, investor, adventure extraordinaire, author of the new book, Adventure Capitalist, The Ultimate Investor's Road Trip, about how this big wide world is shaping up in the 21st century, about the intersection of nationalism and globalism from the village up. Do you see the world as one big global village? Do you see yourself as a global citizen? What is gained when everyone uses the euro? What's lost? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about global investing and the geopolitical landscape in the new millennium with Jim Rogers. He drove his yellow Mercedes around the world for 3 years to the far corners of the earth, far off the beaten path, to witness firsthand how and where the world is shaping up and falling apart. How do you see the forces of globalization in play on the world stage today? Are you investing your money in foreign markets? What have your travels around the world taught you about how the peoples of the world relate to one another, socially, financially, politically? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Jim Rogers, author of the new book, Adventure Capitalist, The Ultimate Investor's Road Trip. Now, Jim, you got married on your trip to your longtime girlfriend, Paige. You were also on the road at 9/11. How did you hear about those attacks? And did you find that people's attitudes changed towards you as an American?
We were in Peru in a town called Puno, which is on Lake Titicaca, and the manager came rushing in and said, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, that something terrible has happened." I thought somebody must have smashed into our car and finished our trip. I wish that's what it had been. He led us down to his office because we didn't have a clue what was going on, and we watched the planes go into the Pentagon and into the Second World Tower. It was pretty astonishing. It spread around the world immediately, and everywhere we went, people were stunned, shocked, just beside themselves for many, many, many reasons. I'm sure the people in New York and Washington were the most stunned, but everywhere we went in the world, people felt sympathy for us, for America, and for what happened.
So you were engulfed by their sympathy, but did you hear any kind of sympathy for the attackers?
Well, as we were in South America, which was pretty, you know, they're pretty close to America politically and economically, and they're all Christians for the most part down there. We did find some sympathy in some parts of the trip later as we got closer to home. There were people who thought that it was a brave act. It was a well-executed act. It was a well-thought-out plan. I mean, who can dispute that? They brought down the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center towers. But for the most part, in South America and Central America, people were much more sympathetic to the U.S.
But when you got to the Arab states, I don't know whether that was before or after.
We had been in the Arab states before.
Right, but you reached the conclusion there that there is no such thing as the Muslim world.
Oh, there's certainly not. There are over a billion Muslims in the world. There are at least two major sects. There are the Sunnis and the Shiites, just as in the Christian world. There are Catholics and Protestants. And many of the people in the Muslim world hate each other. Even within the Sunnis, they hate each other. Even within the Shiites, they are people who hate each other. Just as the Baptists and the Presbyterians have slaughtered each other at times in history. Most of the Muslims don't get along with other Muslims at all.
But the people in the Arab world certainly liked your car. I'm looking at a photo of you here, of an Arab gentleman propped up against it. I would always answer facetiously $1 million when asked how much for the car. These guys promptly responded by asking cash or electronic transfer.
Right. One has to be careful. And then, because in some of the Arabian Peninsula, they got a lot of money. It was always a joke for me to say $1 million, but they were promptly ready to, you know, write out the check.
Jeremy's calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Jim. Jeremy, what would you like to say?
Well, I definitely wanted to agree with the idea of the free movement of people. And I wanted to kind of reiterate my support for that. But I guess my main question was, as someone who has been out protesting at some of the trade summits and things like that, is I think too often the two choices between an economic model are either corporate globalization or a nationalistic kind of protectionism. And I was wondering if you feel that there can be a third way sort of in between, you know, a nationalistic protectionism and then a sort of corporation-run globalization.
Well, the idea that there's corporate-run globalization strikes me as a little crazy, because I've never seen any corporate chieftains who can control the world or control, yes, you can buy politicians, but you've been able to buy politicians for hundreds of years in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. I don't know a third way. If you know a third way, I would certainly be willing to entertain it, and I'm sure everybody else in the world would too. But throughout history, open borders and open trade has been the best. That's how America developed and became a successful country. I would much prefer for us to open our borders to African nations so they can sell to us, rather than protecting our farmers, protecting our factories so that the Africans cannot sell to us. The Africans want to sell. They want to work. They're hardworking, smart people in Africa and South America and Asia who want to produce things and sell. I find that much more practical and much more productive for the world.
Jim, let's just get you back briefly on the road and ask you whether there was anything, as somebody who is very well traveled, anything on your trip that particularly surprised you?
The fact that I'm alive. The most surprising thing is that we're still alive. And the second most surprising thing, Julian, is that we're still married to each other. You know, being in a two-seater for 3 years can be testing. We've just had a little baby, so it's obviously been a successful marriage. We met a young man in California at the last leg of our trip, and he looked at the car and he looked at us and he said, "I can't believe you've been in that car for 3 years for 150,000 miles. My fiance and I set out from Connecticut to drive to California, and we hate each other. I haven't spoken to her in months. She got out of the car in Denver, and I've never seen her since, and I hope to hell that bitch is gone." You know, he was just rabid. Because traveling in a two-seater can be, any kind of overland travel can be very difficult, as you well know.
And
so those were a couple of surprises.
And home again, did you start looking at the country of your birth, the United States, in a very different kind of way?
Oh, of course. There was a poem once called The English Flag by Rudyard Kipling, and there's a line in there that says, "What can he know of England who only England knows?" The point being, you'll learn a whole lot more about your own country if you go away for a while. And of course, when I came back to the U.S., I see things in an entirely different light. I don't like the fact that we meddle in other people's businesses. We have troops in over 100 countries around the world. We're spending over $200 billion a year meddling in other countries. I mean, if the $200 billion a year were bringing us some kind of security, then I could conceivably be in favor of it. But it's just making us enemies. It's not helping at all.
Jim, it's been fascinating talking to you, but I must ask you finally, you've done it on two wheels, you've done it on four, so what next?
Julian, that's a good question. I just had this little daughter for the first time. I've never had a baby. We've gotten her a passport. Don't worry, the first thing we did was go down to get her a passport. I'm not sure what. She's my new adventure at the moment.
Jim Rogers, many, many thanks. And I've been speaking to Jim Rogers, investor, adventure extraordinaire, author of the new book, Adventure Capitalist, The Ultimate Investor's Road Trip. And continue the conversation at our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering legendary rock and roll producer Sam Phillips. This is On Point. Sam Phillips, the man who brought Elvis Presley to the world, died yesterday at the age of 80. A litany of legends passed through his son's studios in Memphis. Phillips crossed the color line in the segregated South of the 1950s with recordings of blues artists Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, Junior Parker, and others. He carried that sound over to Roy Orbison, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins. But Sam Phillips' big breakthrough came on a hot June night in 1954. After hours of stumbling through country tunes, a promising young singer named Elvis Presley tore into That's All Right, a hit on the black charts for Arthur Big Boy Crudup. James Sam Phillips kept the tape rolling, and the rest is history. Nick Spitzer is producer and host of the public radio series American Roots and professor of folklore at the University of New Orleans. He remembers Sam Phillips with this radio diary.
Well, Sam Phillips is a product of the Depression. He comes out of Lawrence, Alabama, a place that produced W.C. Handy, later not too far from Muscle Shoals and that whole scene. I'm one of those people that believes that the great American vernacular heroes often come from places nobody understands why. And he's proud of telling you that early on he was an observer of things in life. He observed sound. He said he loved the sound of crickets when he was a kid. He also grew up poor in a scenario where you had white and black folk working together in the fields and in the economy. And while there were separations socially, there was an awful lot of cultural sharing. And as a man who was an observer, he understood that sharing, and he understood the power in black culture. I think Sam Phillips was a visionary. I think he was a huckster. I think he was a genius. I think he was looking for a white person to sing with the black sound. But before he'd done that, he'd been recording a lot of African-American artists because, one, he loved the music. Two, he knew there was an audience for it and he could sell it. And then finally he got to a point where he wasn't making that much money with his record everything point of view. And he really knew that there was an emerging market among white listeners for the black music. And I think at some level he understood that having a white singer who could handle African-American blues gospel feel would give him a leg up. And in that sense, he's in the tradition of P.T. Barnum to Ed Sullivan, I suppose. He's a showman, and he knew that that was the magic formula, and he was right.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, coming down the line.
When I have asked Sam directly whether Elvis was the guy who made it all happen or if Elvis was somebody that Sam was looking for to fill a vision that Sam had, he always chose the second answer, you know, that Elvis fulfilled his, Sam's vision. Sam did say to me something that he felt he learned from Elvis, which is that raw feel, go on the gut. And he had a great line that he said he learned from Elvis, that you cannot do it right by not doing it wrong. Basically saying, don't try to cut away the things that are wrong in life or in art, but instead focus on what you really believe is the right thing down the middle. And don't worry if it's a little distorted or not quite perfect. Go for the feel. He had a profound appreciation of people like, you know, Rufus Thomas, just as much as, you know, I think he loved Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis. And in them, he heard something that he would describe as raw and powerful, and he had an ear for it. And, you know, he often prided himself on not being somebody jaded by, say, an academic standard or a university-based idea of what music should be or a pop standard of what it should be. He went based on a trueness to his own Southern experience.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Sam was extremely proud of the fact, in retrospect especially, that he had done all these recordings of black artists.
I'm the king of the jungle, they call me the Tiger Man.
Rufus Thomas complained to him that after he found Elvis, that he no longer cared about the black performers. And Sam, I think, had enough self-confidence to say, you know, Rufus is probably right about that. It wasn't that I didn't care about them. But by the time I had done those recordings, all of a sudden, you know, you've got Chess Records, you've got the emerging labels in Memphis that are going to start doing the black music and taking it to a broader audience. And, you know, Sam was a struggling independent businessman, and he realistically saw that he was going to make more money with the rockabilly stuff. And so as a result, you know, he kind of made a business decision. But he looks back in almost every interview I've seen and when I spoke to him, and he has enormous pride in feeling that he crossed the color line and got, you know, Howlin' Wolf out there and got Rufus Thomas and, you know, Rocket 88 and all the great African-American blues that he recorded before the advent of Elvis.
Nick Spitzer is host of American Roots and professor of folklore at the University of New Orleans. And On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Julie Jopp and Sarah Cook, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT.